This podcast is brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Keep Joy on air by becoming a member, a subscriber, or donate. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.
Bored of too many ads and dull, meaningless chat? We've got neither. Joy Drive, smart, fun radio. Sean Dooley, Joy Drive's chief bird nerd.
Good afternoon, Sean Dooley.
Good afternoon, Warren.
I'm really excited about this because the last time we spoke to you, you told us about something that was going on up in Queensland, and it sounded like it was a bit of an important wetland that potentially could have been decimated by development, and it wasn't looking really good. What's happened?
Yeah, well, if you detect a new note in my voice, it's a familiar, it's a feeling I'm not familiar with. It's one of a victory in the conservation game. We don't get them too often, sadly, in Australia because we have such just busted nature laws. And this is one of those cases. Your listeners would remember I spoke about Toondah Harbour on Brisbane's Moreton Bay. If anyone's been out to Stradbroke Island, it's where the ferry comes in from Stradbroke Island. And they, you know, it harks back more than 10 years ago. Campbell Newman was in government in Brisbane, Can Do Campbell, and there was a plan to upgrade the ferry terminal, which everyone was in favour of. Mm. And then the White Shoe Brigade, Campbell's mates, said, oh, while we're at it, why don't we just whack on a 3,200 apartment development complex and associated marina on this area, and to do it, we'll have to take out 42 hectares of Moreton Bay's internationally recognised wetlands that Australia had signed up to protect as part of the Ramsar Agreement. And that sort of, Campbell said, yeah, you beauty, more money for us, and my mates, great. And then it went to the federal government. The federal environment minister at the time was advised by his department, this is crazy, this is an internationally significant area, it harbours a whole bunch of critically endangered and endangered shorebirds and turtles and dugong, and there's koalas nearby that will be impacted by the loss of habitat.
So it's got everything.
And so it had the lot. It was like one of the most no-brainer decisions an environment minister could ever make. But unfortunately, because our nature laws are broken, the minister's allowed to just have a captain's call and said, no, I think we'll let this proceed. So it's been like, you know, almost a decade of community action up there. BirdLife Australia got involved through our Southern Queensland branch and then through the national office, because this is not just a Brisbane issue, it's a national and international issue. Mm. All eyes were on Australia here, because if we were able to just with impunity destroy 42 hectares of internationally recognised wetlands, it could happen anywhere. And finally, the current Environment Minister, Tanya Plibersek, has come out and said, nah, sorry, blokes, this is not happening. And she's rejected the proposal.
Fantastic.
And the developers have pulled out now and said they're not going to resubmit in that form or anyway. But the trouble is, it's taken 10 years of extreme dedication from all the volunteers in the local community, and supported by organisations like BirdLife and our volunteers and campaigners. And it really shouldn't have been this hard. It was a really clear-cut case, and it just shows how broken our nature laws are. And the other bit of news is that Tanya Plibersek announced roughly the same week that she's going to kick the can down the road in reforming our nature laws until next year, which is, of course, an election year. So who knows whether we'll get those reforms put before the parliament, before the term of this government that they said they would. And we desperately need them, because it's not just those birds that turn to, like, eastern curlews and bar-tailed godwits and the dugongs and turtles. There's species birds across Australia that are still plummeting towards extinction.
So if this had gone out, like, what have we saved now in terms of Toondah Harbour? Like, if this had happened, what would have been the impact on, I mean, because I'm sure it would have been reached further than just around Moreton Bay in terms of the damage and the impact. What have we avoided by doing the right thing in this case?
Yeah, in the immediate area, we've avoided losing 42 hectares of mangroves and mudflats and real sort of nurseries for fish and other things. And that itself, like, we, you know, our volunteers had recorded up to 76 eastern curlews, which is a bird, our largest migratory shorebird, and they have declined by over 80% in the last 40 years. So, you know, when Moreton Bay is probably the most important area for them when they spend the summer here in all of Australia, and the bulk of the population migrate to Australia. So it's a huge win for those birds and the other birds around it. But even more so, there would have been more traffic, more boat traffic, more jet skis, all that stuff disturbing a whole far greater area than the actual development. But as I said, if Australia had successfully argued that, oh, we can just change our commitment to protecting these areas that we've signed up to internationally and put a development on them, then there's like 85 other countries that are signed up to this as well, and they could similarly cave into development developers' pressures. So it's actually a huge victory internationally, not just for those birds in that local area.
I'm glad that common sense has prevailed there, and it's great to hear a good news story, because we do hear a lot of negative stuff. Yes. We also spoke something else while we're on the stuff that was a little bit concerning. We spoke about the threatened swift parrot. What's happening with that? I believe you've seen some sightings where they perhaps shouldn't be seen.
Yes, well, it's sort of that they're a really tricky bird to protect, and we, as we spoke last time about it, their population is down to about 500 left in the wild, and they're tricky to protect because not only are we seeing the Tasmanian government cutting down forests where they nest in still in Tasmania, and the New South Wales government cutting down forests where they spend the winter in New South Wales, but even where in Victoria, where we aren't cutting down their forests, they move around and they follow throughout the winter the flowering of the eucalypts. Because we've got so many winter flowering eucalypts in Melbourne and Geelong, you can actually get this critically endangered bird. And I'm talking a bird that there's fewer swift parrots in the world than there are pandas. Wow. You know, this bird's seriously, seriously on the brink of extinction. But they're turning up in Melbourne suburbs and down near Geelong. Already this season, since they've flown over from Tasmania, we've had reports coming from Ocean Grove, Altona, Newport, Brunswick, Epping, Beaumaris, all suburbs in Melbourne and near Geelong. So they're actually one of the rarest animals on the planet, and people can go out and see them. Now, they're a bit tricky to identify because they like feeding on the nectar from the yuki flowers like the lorikeets, but they're a bit thinner and more streamlined than your average lorikeet, and they have a slightly different call. They've got this beautiful sort of dit 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 call that they give as they fly around frantically searching for the nectar. They, like a lot of the smaller lorikeets, they're green, but you can tell a swift parrot if you see it up close, because they sort of look like they've put their face in the jam jar, and they've kind of got this blotch of red around their bill. And also, they have a long tail. There's another little lorikeet called the little lorikeet, which also has got into the jam jar. It's got red around the face, but it's much more, it's tiny and chunky and has a very short tail. And if people think they've seen a swift parrot, the best thing you could possibly do is to let us at BirdLife Australia know. We're coordinating with parrot search this winter, and there's currently a phase for the next 6 weeks where we want people to report any sightings of swift parrots into our swift parrot search portal, which is on our bird data system. But if you just type in swift parrot search, you'll be able to find how that you can register for that search, because they spread themselves out so thinly across all of the mainland, eastern Australia. Like, there's also birds currently turning up on the central coast in New South Wales, and they can go as far as Port Macquarie or even up to Toowoomba in Queensland. So we need a lot of eyes out there, because there's only 500 and it's a very, very big country that they could be hiding in. So we want to know where they are so that we can work out how to better protect them.
So do the swift parrot search and all the details will come up. Just on that, a couple of things come to mind, and one is the importance, and I've certainly done this in my little courtyard. I've planted a sort of a miniature one, but it's a eucalyptus tree, but it covers itself in flowers, and I notice, you know, parrots, all sorts of birds come in and feed on it when it's in flower. So the importance of planting things in our gardens where we can and we have the opportunity, that does provide food for native wildlife. What do you reckon, Sean?
Oh, it does, most definitely. And in the case of the swift parrot, the fact that they're turning up in certain suburbs of Melbourne is often, maybe once upon a time there were winter flowering gum trees there that were cleared long ago, but they have kind of like a generational memory, and they go searching for food. They almost like have a code that of embedded in their minds as to where to look for food. But what we've done since, especially since the 60s and 70s, is planted a lot of native plants, and a lot of the swift parrot records around Melbourne are coming from trees that weren't originally here, so they're not indigenous to the region. But trees like the spotted gum or some of the ironbarks or southern mahoganies that have been planted in gardens and also street trees around Melbourne have become, they're winter flowering trees, and that's when the swift parrots are here. So they've just latched onto those with great delight, and that's why we get them in the city, because people had the foresight to plant native plants.
What about in terms of them being able to increase their numbers, to breed up in numbers? Can they do that in an urban environment if there is the right tree?
It's tricky because they're so heavily migratory. The entire population migrates across Bass Strait to Tasmania, and they'll only nest in Tasmania. So they rely on the spring and summer flowering eucalypts, like the blue gum that they get in Tasmania. So they can theoretically, and they do nest in nest boxes, and they can nest in sort of suburban areas around Hobart and Launceston. But what they need is nesting sites, usually old trees, old eucalypts, that are big enough to have developed hollows. But even if you've put nest boxes in, they need to be near forests full of blue gum that's in flower. And the tricky thing in Tasmania is that the blue gum forests don't all flower at once, which is good because it means the swift parrots can move sites each year, so they'll nest in a different location every year, and they, if the blue gum forests flower repeatedly, they work it out and they come and they'll use those nesting sites again. But but this is why they're so hard to protect, because you need multiple sites to protect their breeding habitat. And even though our bird life staff and volunteers and researchers from ANU and others have identified nesting sites and feeding areas for swift parrots when they are nesting, unfortunately, the ironically named Sustainable Timbers Tasmania keeps cutting down some of those logging coops.
Why not? Let's clear the wetlands in Queensland and knock down the blue gums.
Exactly. And this is where our nature laws fail us again, because the way they're written, Tanya Plibersek, the federal government, could come in and say, hang on, this is what's driving them to extinction. You've got to stop it, Tasmania. But there's a specific exception, a get-out-of-jail-free clause for the timber industry. And they actually exempt the timber industry from having the Environment Act apply to them. So as long as the timber industry or the state governments, in consultation with the timber industry, say, yep, nothing to see here, then the federal government has to accept that. And it's just outrageous and bizarre and incredible that that was allowed to get in there, and it's still in our laws. And we're seeing the impacts in real time with swift parrot. They're going extinct in real time. Like, every year there are fewer and fewer. And we expect by the end of this decade, there'll you know, I thought that the new Tasmanian AFL team should have been called the Tasmanian Swift Parrots. Forget the Tasmanian Devils, the Tasmanian Swift Parrots. But the irony would be is if that was the case, there may well be fewer Swift Parrots than players by the end of the by the end of this decade, the way things are going.
Very sad news. Even our newsreader's dog got upset at that news. Let's talk about migratory birds, because you're a bird watcher's called twitchers. Is that the right term?
Yes. It's the for the hardcore ones that go chasing rare birds.
Right, twitchers.
That's called, you're a twitcher and you go on a twitch. You twitch that rare bird.
So the twitchers have been twitching and now they're excited. Why?
Oh, yes. This is a great time of year because you're seeing birds on migration, and so they'll turn up in spots where they're not normally seen. And there's one that's turned up at the Western Treatment Plant out at Werribee that is taken a wrong turn at Albuquerque. It should at this time of year be in America, in Alaska, actually, in the Arctic Circle breeding.
Was it using Apple Maps or Google Maps?
Yeah, its internal GPS has gone bung. Ooh. And this one, instead of heading north, it's headed south and on the wrong side of the Pacific. And it might have migrated here at the start of the season, but and we didn't notice it because they look very similar to a bird that does migrate to Australia called the Pacific Golden Plover. And they're really hard to tell when they're in their drab non-breeding plumage. But now that it's breeding time, it's got this amazing black belly and white streaks and then golden flecks on the top of its body. And it's distinguishable from the Pacific Golden Plover. And there's one out at Werribee, and it's the first time that a breeding plumage one has been seen for a long time. It's probably only the sixth accepted record. There's been a few claims, but people can't prove them because they're really hard to tell apart. So because this is a genuine record, because it's unmistakable in its breeding plumage, the twitchers have been going nuts and heading out to the sewage farm, the Western Treatment Plant, and just soaking in this beautiful bird. But the trouble is it's on the wrong side of the world.
Ooh,
and
it's gonna
all
be okay?
of its, all of its, we don't know. I mean, this is the thing. It's tinged with sadness. Something's gone wrong for this. Mm. Its migration's gone awry. It could be a genetic thing that's made it migrate in the wrong direction. It could have been blown off course. We don't know. And a lot of times these vagrant birds do end up never making it back home. And they might die, or they just live out their life here without their own kind. But not to be too pessimistic, sometimes these birds actually return year after year. And even though they're not meant to be here, they take Australia to their liking. And so I guess they're like, you know, the Mason Cox or the Marsha Hines of the bird world that have, you know, come from America and decided, hey, I like it here. And they return year after year. So sometimes it is a story where the twitchers are happy and the bird's completely content to be doing what it's doing.
And you know what, Sean? It might also be that it's smart and thinking, you know, the world's changing. Climate change is changing things.
Yes.
I found a new home and it might bring 20,000 of them one day.
Yeah.
You never know.
Sometimes this could be the case. We've certainly have seen in the last 10 to 20 years heaps more of these vagrant birds turning up all around the world. And you could say, well, there's more bird watchers looking for them, which is true. But even the statistics show that the rate of these birds turning up where they shouldn't normally be is getting higher and higher. And we think that's actually likely related to climate factors, either stronger winds, more intense storms or cyclones that blow birds off course, or it could just be habitat change. They're having to fly further afield. The weather patterns are different. They're migrating at slightly different times. So we're going to see more and more of this into the future.
Sean, great to chat with you and some good news. Thank you for sharing it with us. We'll chat to you next time.
I hope I've got more good news for you then, Warren.
Thank you. That's Sean Dooley, the National Public Affairs Officer at BirdLife Australia.
Joy Drive on Joy 94.9 FM in Melbourne, Joy on your digital radio, iHeartRadio, TuneIn.com or the Joy app, no matter where you are.
Thanks for listening to another Joy podcast brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Help us keep Joy on air. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.